There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
This third and final hour of the show comes with a health warning specifically for Southampton football fans. I know we've got the Southampton Supporters Club downstairs down here at Barasti. They've gone very quiet. Why? Mark Archer.
10 minutes ago, Southampton were winning this match and they were moving out of the bottom three of the Premiership. But the super sub has come on for Chelsea, Olivier Giroud. He's got a double. Eden Hazard has added the second goal, and currently with 10 minutes remaining on the South Coast, it's the tail has been turned in this match. Chelsea 3, Southampton 2. And Southampton were cruising in the second half. Chelsea hardly had a look, a shot on goal. They were creating chances, but now 10 minutes remaining. Three goals in 8 minutes for Chelsea. Giroud header, Giroud finish, Eden Hazard. It's 3-2 Chelsea.
Makes it very interesting down at the bottom of the table. In fact, that's where our focus is going to be from 6 o'clock local time here in the UAE. You will hear live coverage of Crystal Palace, currently in 17th position, just above the relegation zone, taking on Brighton, who are four places above them, up in 13th at the moment. It is a derby. Adam Bridge is calling this one for us from 6 o'clock. He joins us live on the line. It's been billed as a derby, Adam, and we've been trying to do our history and our homework as well. Why is this a derby?
It's all based on the M23 motorway, actually, because that's what connects the two places. So there's about 47 miles between them. So it's I think it's potentially the widest distance between any two clubs for a derby, because it is, as I say, 47 miles. But it's a bitter rivalry. I think there's about 45 miles between Sunderland and Middlesbrough, but then they often up there don't class that as a derby. So we'll take it on face value, but they don't like each other. So as far as I'm concerned, that qualifies.
Crystal Palace have had some injury problems of late. I suppose one of the big questions for Crystal Palace fans is, will Christian Benteke start for Palace today? Do you have an answer to that for us yet?
I do. It's quite a surprising answer, actually, because the answer is no. In a game you feel they'd need to win, you'd think maybe the option of having the big man back would have enticed them to play him. But both he and Sorloth, who are both back from injury, only get places on the bench today from Roy Hodgson. So Palace actually have lined up in almost an identical lineup. They welcome back Joel Ward today, who comes in at right back for Wan-Bissaka. Aside from that, there as you were, so we expect to see Loftus-Cheek and MacArthur playing in the wide areas with Townsend and Zahar up front. They obviously performed very well against Bournemouth last week in that 2-2 draw. Probably should have got away with the points had Bournemouth not come and rescued the game in the dire moments, as they have so many times this season. So Roy Hodgson feels quite comfortable with that. I mean, it is a massive game. It's undoubtedly one of the best atmospheres in the Premier League. A Brighton side who can't really score away from home. So you'd feel today is a day for Palace to go for it. But in his eyes, the way of going for it is to use Zahar and Townsend in those advanced roles.
Adam, just looking at Brighton and looking back at the season that they've had as well, I mean, so much going on at the bottom end of the table at the moment with the relegation battle in full flow, as is being borne out by Southampton at the moment on the big screen down here at Barasti. Are Brighton safe in your mind?
No, I don't think so. I think they need another win probably to secure their position. And I think any Brighton fan would have probably snapped your hand off to be in this position with four or five games remaining in the season. They've had peaks and troughs of form, of course. They didn't start particularly well, but then went through a real purple patch. Chris Hughton picked up a Manager of the Month award for when they were in particularly good form. But they have found it a little bit difficult to win at home. And the one thing they've had all season is this inability to score goals away, just the seven of them on the road in the Premier League. And you and I may remember the pain that three of those came at the London Stadium. That's a really poor return for the rest of the season for them, and they just struggle to score goals away from home. And again, when you think that actually their main striker and their main kind of breadwinner and points winner is Glenn Murray throughout, the veteran striker, he's been the mainstay of that side. But I think they've done really well to get themselves in this position. Chris Hughton's a top bloke and a really good manager, and give themselves a fighting chance and be within probably three or four points of safety at this stage, I think is a terrific achievement.
Adam, it's been a fascinating week following European fortunes, also with that Manchester derby last week. Just want to cast your eye forward to the late kickoff this evening in the Premier League. Tottenham at home to Manchester City. Will Manchester City clinch that title this evening?
No, I don't think they will, actually. I think Spurs will be well organised and well structured. And I think what we saw a little bit of in the second half against Liverpool from City, and I mean, you could factor some things in. The disallowed goal before half-time maybe is one of the factors in it. But I just thought they started to look a little bit leggy. And we saw a little bit of that last week as well in the second half of the game against Manchester United. He hasn't changed the squad an awful lot. He has got great depth and quality in certain positions, but they've been competing on every front throughout this campaign. And I just thought in that second half against Liverpool, it looked like tiredness was beginning to get. The high intensity they play, the way he wants to play, and in particular in that game, the way they went about getting at Liverpool and the formation they had involved an awful lot of hard work and an awful lot of running. And I think it started to tell its toll. I think Spurs are really well organised at home. Now they've settled into Wembley. I think they will deny Man City a victory. Whether they can win the game themselves is a different matter. I think we're going to have to wait a little bit longer. And actually, if they won it next week against Swansea at home, I suspect that's going to be no great disaster for Pep Guardiola.
Just a quick one from me, Adam, and we listen on week after week to your commentary from the UK of the Premier League. And one question I've always meant to ask, I never really got around to asking you, so I'm going to ask it now. Is of all the games that you've commentated on, is there one particular name, one player that you enjoy enunciating or speaking the most? Or on the flip side of that, is there one player that you've had in your career that you just it was a nightmare for you as well?
That's a very, very good question, actually. In terms of players that I enjoy watching, there is no doubt about it that watching De Bruyne play, or as we often have many debates over here, is it De Bruyne or is it De Bruyne? Well, actually, if we're giving him his Belgian pronunciation, it's probably De Bruyne, but everyone here calls him De Bruyne. In terms of watching somebody play, I think there are very few better that has the ability to just open up a defence and then the next minute look so incredibly casual. And so eager to please and has his range of passing and his ability. So he causes me issues when it comes to announcing his name, but I do enjoy watching him. In terms of those who I won't have as Premier League footballers, there's a list as long as your arm. So I won't even start that list. Thankfully, none of them are playing today. Let's put it that way. I quite like the look of these two Palace and Brighton sides today. They've got some decent players in there. But yeah, I think there are a few players who are far from Premier League quality and are getting away with it, Patrice Evra.
Adam, on that subject, Kevin De Bruyne has been nominated this afternoon, shortlisted for the PFA Players of the Year Award. Just want to get your thoughts on that list and who you think is the front runners. We've been debating a bit earlier on the show. Obviously, De Bruyne is going to be in there. Mo Salah is going to be mentioned in that mix. But you've also got David De Gea, Harry Kane, Leroy Sané, and David Silva. Where do you see that award going and why?
I think it's quite interesting, actually, when you look at who the other players have picked out, because probably the one I expected most of that list, the one that's probably crept under the radar, is David Silva, because I think in amongst all the jewels and gems you find at Manchester City, I think that just shows that his fellow pros who kind of come up against him week in, week out, have a real appreciation of what he offers that Manchester City side. If you'd asked me probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I'd have been very much in the De Bruyne camp. I just think it's really hard to ignore the quantity of goals that Salah has scored this season and the impact he's had on that Liverpool side. He's a one-man machine for them, and I think probably that, if anything, if I had to vote right now, would probably sway it in his favour as far as I was concerned.
Prediction time for you now, Adam. Roy Hodgson is appealing for calm both on and off the pitch when Crystal Palace play Brighton. It is our feature game at 6. Who's going to win it?
I love the atmosphere here, and I think that's what will drive Palace on today. I've actually not been since the game against Chelsea when they won the 2-1 to get their first goals and their first win of the season. So I think we'll see more of the same today. I think Brighton's travails will continue, and I think we'll see a 2-1 victory today for Crystal Palace.
Looking forward to it. Thanks so much indeed for your time. As always, Adam Bridge, who will be calling the game for us from 6. Thanks, Adam.
Cheers, guys.
Big thanks to Adam, and as I said, you can listen to that game live and uninterrupted from 6 o'clock local time here in the UAE. It is Palace against Brighton, and then stay tuned because you've got football aplenty to look forward to later on. Liverpool against Bournemouth, also live, and a little bonus as well. We've got a late game on a Saturday, which sees Spurs take on City. Why on earth have we got... Oh, and we're going to get to that one in just a few moments' time. We'll take a short break when we come back. More sport live here from Barresti.
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, where the game is always on.
Indeed it is, and let's talk about that game because we're watching the final 10 minutes of the opening game in the Premier League. Southampton against Chelsea. Mark Archer, what's the tale of the tape on this one?
Well, it was Southampton 2-0 at half-time and cruising, but 3 goals in 8 minutes has seen Chelsea take the lead, 3-2. They were currently in injury time. We're in the 92nd minute. There was 5 minutes of added time for this match. Can Chelsea hold on for a victory? Second half goals, 2 to the super sub, Olivier Giroud. The third was added by Eden Hazard. In the first half, it was Dusan Tadic who scored the first goal for Southampton after 21 minutes. That lead was doubled early in the second half by Bednarek. But 3 goals between minutes 70 and 78 has seen Chelsea take the lead. So with 3 minutes remaining of added time, Chelsea 3, Southampton 2.
Motherwell have reached the Scottish Cup final. They've beaten Aberdeen by 3-0 a little earlier on today. And it finished 2 apiece in the early over in La Liga between Villarreal and Sevilla. 2 apiece. And both teams reduced 10 men for the final 20 minutes of that game. Grand National a little later on. Plenty more sport to get through as well. Paul Espy's alongside us. So we've just been talking about those late kickoffs that we've got for you. Palace against Brighton is our feature game from 6 o'clock. Just looking at the result as it stands here for Southampton, they're in a dangerous position, aren't they? Just can't get themselves out of that relegation zone.
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning of the season, I was a little bit concerned that it was just going to be a yo-yo situation with the Championship teams, Newcastle, Huddersfield and Brighton. I couldn't see how, in particular, Huddersfield and Brighton could stay up, but obviously they started the season so well, and Brighton have been pretty excellent. I think I agree with what was said before. I think Chris Hughton is a phenomenal manager. He's proven it time and time and time again. But yeah, it's, Stoke, Southampton, obviously West Brom look as if they've gone. Swansea, I mean, it looks like it's going to be probably between those three, between two out of Southampton, Swansea and Stoke. I think Stoke, to me, seem as if they've gone. So, I don't know. I think it's not looking favourable for Southampton. It worries me as well because I wonder how they'd get back up into the Premier League. They've got quite a small ground under the circumstances, haven't they? They're very small. I think only 3 or 4 teams have got a smaller one than them in the Premier League. I was amazed. Bournemouth's ground's only got a capacity of about 11,000. It's insane. I say that, obviously, Bournemouth are playing Liverpool, and I hopefully we'll get a result. But, yeah, I mean, Chelsea have done brilliantly this half here, and again, it concerns me as a Liverpool fan that Chelsea are going to pick up this result because I still think they're nipping at the heels of Liverpool. And if Liverpool do well in the Champions League, if they get the results against Roma, you can only see the Premier League being secondary for their concerns. And, you know, could they lose fourth place in the long run?
Let's go stateside now for all the latest from the world of basketball. The 2018 NBA playoffs start in the wee small hours of tomorrow morning for us, a Saturday night over in the States. Thrilling end to the regular season. Mark Archer, even I stayed up to watch one of these the other day. I was entranced by the Wolves game, the Timberwolves.
Yeah, Timberwolves had a must-win match. They were taking on the Denver Nuggets, and whoever won that match after 82 games were going to get the final spot between those two teams. It worked out amazingly. But it was the young, talented Minnesota Timberwolves making the first playoffs since 2004. That's when I lived there, actually, back in Minnesota. Really? It was the last time they were in the playoffs. Remember big Kevin Garnett doing his thing there. So the playoffs are always fascinating. We've had 82 matches in the regular season. The playoffs get underway tomorrow morning. And what happens is they half the team. So the top 8 teams in the Eastern Conference make the playoffs. The top 8 teams in the Western Conference make the playoffs. It's all to play for now. Of course, the last 3 finals have between the Cleveland Cavaliers, who have won the East, and the Golden State Warriors, who have won the West. But it's not, those two teams aren't quite having it all their way this season, Tom. Let's just start with the Eastern Conference playoffs. I'll give you a rundown of the teams there, and we'll listen to some audio. It's the Toronto Raptors have finished in first position. They will take on, in the best-of-7 series, the Washington Wizards, who finished in 8th. Second in the East was the Boston Celtics. They'll take on the Milwaukee Bucks. Philadelphia 76ers with the young, talented Aussie, who could be Rookie of the Year, Ben Simmons. They will take on the Miami Heat. And then Cleveland Cavaliers with the King, LeBron James. Never rule him out come playoff time. They've finished in lowly 4th. So the Cleveland Cavaliers in 4th will take on the Indiana Pacers. Let's just have a quick listen to the predictions on how these Eastern Conference playoffs are going to unfold.
Can LeBron carry Cleveland again? Are the Sixers as dangerous as they seem? And can Toronto get over the postseason hump? It's the Eastern Conference playoffs. I'm here with Sam Amick and Jeff Zoga to break it all down. All right, Jeff, let's start with 1 vs. 8, Raptors versus Wizards. You know, obviously we know the Wizards have the talent, but as they've showed for much of the season, talent only gets you so far. Can they give these Raptors some trouble?
They're trending in the wrong direction at the wrong time of the season. John Wall coming back from injury has not re-energized the team the way people thought. I know the Raptors struggled a bit down the stretch, but this is a 1 vs. 8 matchup. There's a reason why the Raptors are the top seed in the East. They have the goods.
All right, Sam, you know, one of the toughest series to pick is Boston versus Milwaukee. I mean, it's not your traditional 7 vs. 2 matchup, obviously, because the Celtics don't have Kyrie Irving. Can this gritty group led by Brad Stevens advance?
I'm going to give the X factor to Brad Stevens. You know, the Bucks obviously had a coaching change earlier in the year. Joe Prunty trying to keep that team with its head above water. Giannis Antetokounmpo with a lot to play for. He's 0-2 in first round playoff series, trying to advance to the second round for the first time. But I think Boston, even ailing, even without Kyrie Irving, even without Marcus Smart, most likely is still going to edge this one out and get the best of the Bucks.
Jeff, you know, the Pacers won the season series with the Cavs, but all four of those games were played before that trade deadline roster overhaul. Can Indy give Cleveland and your MVP, LeBron James, a run for their money?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Indiana's been fantastic all year. But here's the deal with Cleveland. LeBron is spectacular in first-round series, incredibly difficult to beat. And I'll say this every series until we get to the finals. Beating LeBron 4 times in the Eastern Conference playoffs is going to be difficult for any team, and I don't think Indiana can pull it off.
All right, and Sam, how about the Sixers and the Heat, with the Sixers being the hottest team in the NBA heading into the playoffs?
Yeah, I'm definitely giving the edge to the Sixers. This Miami team, though, has been so much fun and so counterintuitive all season long when it comes to what we thought they were going to be. But Philly, not only with how they're playing, but also the prospect of Joel Embiid maybe coming back. He said he's unlikely for game one with that left eye orbital fracture, which sounds so painful. I think he's going to be back in the fold at some point during this series, and I think Philly advances.
Fun fact, Miami actually won the aggregate score of the season series 409-407, so it was definitely a close 4 games that they played.
That's a breakdown of the Eastern Conference playoffs. They get underway tomorrow. Let's just switch directions to the Western Conference, so often the stronger conference in the NBA. The big surprise here was the number one seems that the best team in the NBA season and the regular season was the Houston Rockets, not the Golden State Warriors. Of course, the MVP in waiting, James Harden, had an amazing season. They finished with a 65-17 record. In second place, so the Houston there in first will take on the Minnesota Timberwolves, the last team to qualify in the eighth spot. The Golden State Warriors, who got the 2 seed, Steph Curry is missing in the first round. He's got an injury, taking on the San Antonio Spurs. Let's see how that match unfolds there. Greg Popovich always does a wonderful job organizing the Spurs. The 3 seed, the Portland Trailblazers, will take on the New Orleans Pelicans. And then the last matchup in the Western Conference playoffs sees the Oklahoma City Thunder, last season's MVP Russell Westbrook, taking on the fast-finishing Utah Jazz. Let's just listen to how this Western Conference playoffs break down.
Are the Warriors healthy enough for another run to the finals? Or is this the Rockets' year? Who is on upset alert? It's the Western Conference playoffs, and I'm here with Sam Amick and Jeff Zoget to break it all down. Sam, so obviously, I mean, these Rockets have been a cut above everyone else all season long, but they're playing a T-Wolves team that had to go all 82 to get in. You know, the Rockets also dominated the season series. Is there any chance that Minnesota puts up a fight?
Maybe somewhat of a fight. The energy when they're going to be in Minnesota is going to be through the roof, but Houston is playing at such a high level. The evidence from these 4 matchups is not pretty. The Rockets scored 122.8 points on average in the 4 matchups. I expect them to have a relatively easy time going forward.
Jeff, maybe the most fun matchup of the entire playoffs or the entire first round is New Orleans and Portland. I mean, you have two players having career years and who are really in the top 5 of the MVP conversation in Anthony Davis and Damian Lillard. Who do you see taking this one?
I'm going to lean toward Portland, but by no means am I super confident in that. This Pelicans team has been fantastic the past 2.5 months of the season. This is not your normal 3-6 matchup. I do like Portland in a deep and long series, but it will not surprise me if the Pelicans found a way to eke this out.
All right, Sam, you know, the Warriors-Spurs series, obviously missing a couple key pieces, but is this the best possible matchup the Warriors could have had as they wait for Steph Curry to get healthy?
I don't think so, only out of my respect for Greg Popovich. I still, if I'm the Warriors, I'm just worried about what he's going to concoct in the coaching room to try to pull off this upset or at least make life tough on the Warriors. But in the absence of Kawhi, the Warriors should be okay, but it's worth watching. The Warriors are vulnerable, and I talked to Kobe Bryant, who knows better than anybody about championship basketball, the other day about this topic, and he agreed. He said, of course they're vulnerable. The Rockets are rolling. They feel good. If you're the Spurs, you try to take your best shot at it. LaMarcus Aldridge needs to be that MVP caliber player that he's been for a lot of the season. Their defense has been tremendous. Offensively, without Steph Curry, the Warriors are not the same team on that end of the floor. So I think it could be interesting.
And Jeff, break down the Thunder and the Jazz. So the Thunder have more talent, but the Jazz finished the second half of the season as one of the best teams in the entire league.
So another series that I could see going 6-7 games. I actually like the Utah Jazz here for the very reason that you just mentioned. They were one of the best teams in the league from January 1 through the end of the regular season. Quinn Snyder is at the top of my Coach of the Year list. They have Rudy Gobert, who's the top Defensive Player of the Year candidate, roaming the middle. And they have Rookie of the Year candidate Donovan Mitchell. That's a lot to ask for a rookie to carry a team in his first playoff series. But he's been doing it all season long, and there's no reason to expect that Quinn Snyder and that group that he has won't get it done against Oklahoma City.
That's a breakdown of the Eastern Conference playoffs. We've now looked at what's going to happen in the East, what's going to happen in the West. Two men's opinions that we love to hear this time of the year because they're always colorful, they always agree to disagree, is our good friends at ESPN, Stephen A. Smith and Max Kellerman. This, they talk about their finals predictions.
Right now, I want to quickly get your two teams, your finals picks, and who's going to win it all. Stephen A.
I got the Warriors meeting the Cavs. It's a rematch. LeBron James is coming out of the East. That's just the way that I see it. Unless if he gets knocked up by Toronto, it would be Philly. But I don't think that's going to happen. It'll be LeBron meeting Philly in the conference finals. They will win. Ultimately, he will run into the Warriors, who's a juggernaut. They'll have a seven-game series against Houston, but Steph Curry will be back. Golden State will win that series in seven. They will meet the Cavs, and they will take LeBron and the Cavs out in five.
The finals will feature neither the Cavs nor the Warriors. The Rockets over Toronto in five games.
Got to admit, if that happens,
what?
Toronto and Houston, that's not a bad thing for me, Max Kellerman. I'm talking about socially.
Sure.
It's a lot to do. It's a lot to do in those towns, Max Kellerman. Those are beautiful towns to be in for the finals, I must admit.
But Stephen A., can you actually
it's
see
chalk.
That
Listen,
happening?
There's a...
Come on.
No, not for me. I can't see it. I can't see that happening.
Max, why are you going with those teams?
Well, there's a reason that... Because, listen, there's a reason that that's the number one seed in the East and the number one seed in the West. The Raptors, really, it's mainly because there's no one else there who I'm scared of if I'm a Raptors fan once Kyrie went down for Boston. But the Houston Rockets, as I always point out, have practically not lost when healthy, and here they're healthy, and Steph still hasn't played for the Warriors. But even if Steph was fully healthy, at no point were the Warriors as good as the Rockets have been when fully loaded this season, and the Rockets are fully loaded.
Hot take right there. How about it, Max? Love that you guys don't disagree. And Stephen A. going for the four-peat.
Let's go.
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, with more sport, the latest headlines, and top debate on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Yeah, plenty of games to talk about, plenty of sports to talk about. Let's go to the cricket now because that is live action from the IPL. Let's get the latest, Mark Archer.
Yes, the first of two doubleheaders coming on doubleheader Saturday from the IPL. The second match coming up after this one is at Eden Gardens, Kolkata. It's KKR, the Knight Riders, taking on Sunrisers Hyderabad. Hyderabad have started the season well, but it's a fascinating clash, though, at Wankhede Stadium. No team wants to start the IPL with three consecutive losses, which does face the losing team in this competition, Mumbai Indians. Batted first, 194 for 7, they scored in their 20 overs. And Delhi Daredevils going along well, 137 for 7 after 14 of their 20 overs. It's the Englishman Jason Roy doing the damage, opening the batting for Delhi. He is 61 not out off only 35 deliveries. Four fours and four sixes for Jason Roy. So it currently Delhi require 58 more runs. They have 7 wickets remaining. 36 balls remaining. So this game is very much in the balance. I'll keep you posted with runs and wickets as we get to the conclusion of this match, Tom.
Thanks so much indeed. We've got Paul Espy with us here today, so we're going to take this opportunity to talk all things tennis. What's the focus at the moment for those on tour?
Well, we've just come off the back of Davis Cup weekend, and now we're moving over to the European clay court season, or should we just say the Nadal part of the season, because it seems to be that we're breaking up the tour into two events when it comes to our two people when it comes to the men. And I think where the ladies are concerned, it's just, you know, tossing a coin or something.
I want to talk Davis Cup there, stop, but now we're going to talk Rafa and clay. Davis Cup, is it still relevant? And B, there's been a lot of suggestions about a new format for the Davis Cup, which seems to confuse everyone, and some players agree, some players disagree. Just put us in the picture with Davis Cup. Where are we at? Does anyone care? And what's going to happen with the Davis Cup competition going forward?
Well, not that it means anything, but I care. I think the frustrating thing about Davis Cup and the way that the sport is going is that it's trying to turn everything into the individual side of it and taking everything away from the teams. Davis Cup has been part of the tennis foundations for, like, I think almost 90 years, 80 years. And, you know, it would be sad to think that they would change the format. And at the end of the day, it's a choice. And Nadal chose to play this weekend, and he played incredibly well. Won both his matches. He's just got the most unbelievable record. He's lost one match, and it was a doubles match. And I don't even think it was a live rubber. In all of his Davis Cup time, they want to try and change it and bring in an end of season after the Masters finals. So in November time, they want to have a 1 week 16 team competition, which some players have said, yeah, this would be interesting. People like Hewitt have said, absolutely not, waste of time. And I'm completely with Hewitt on this. I think we have the Laver Cup now, which is a new addition to the calendar. I think it's a fantastic event, and it really did sort of open up a few more sort of eyes to what's possible. You know, the Kyrgios versus Federer match, the doubles, we finally got to see Federer and Nadal play doubles together, which was spectacular. It's one of my memories from last year for sure. But to take away the Davis Cup and all the history that's behind it, I did my podcast last week, and I had Omar Berusian, who's he's actually the UAE number one. He's been the UAE number one for 22 years or something, 23 years. And he actually is in the world record books once for the youngest ever Davis Cup live rubber win. It was 14 years old against a Jordanian guy. He took that record off Bjorn Borg. You know, Bjorn Borg had it. He played against a guy from, it was 15, he played against a guy, number four in the world from New Zealand, actually. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. Now, you lose the Davis Cup, I'm sorry, but UAE is a very much sort of a young nation, a developing nation. You lose the Davis Cup, and what happens to those records? You know, Omar Berusian, as a we call him the godfather of UAE tennis, you know, there is a guy that would basically have a world record which would be forgotten about purely based on the fact that people, you know, say that the calendar is too stacked. I couldn't disagree more. These guys are playing probably around about, I'd say, 26 weeks in a year. You know, they don't always get to the final. They're not Federer. They're not all Nadals. They don't get to every single final. They're often playing 3 or 4 days, so it's more training than anything else. So it's a choice. In the last 10 years, Federer, Wawrinka, Djokovic, Nadal, Murray have all won the Davis Cup, and it meant huge amounts to them. So losing it from the calendar, I believe, would be the biggest error of judgment that the ATP could have possibly done.
Let's turn our attention, as Arch was saying there, to the clay season. Obviously, there is one name that will dominate proceedings, but I'm just wondering if there are others that we could throw into the mix. Obviously, well documented that some of the big four are still struggling with their individual and respective injuries. Rafa Nadal preparing himself specifically for this clay court season. But who are the also-runners out there at the moment? Who could push Nadal this year on clay?
Well, I think it's important to note that that Nadal has got 4,600 points to defend on clay this year. So he won all of the tournaments bar one last year. I think it was Rome he lost. I think Dominic Thiem took that. Dominic Thiem is the one that I would have thought would be jumping on his heels right now. He unfortunately has had a bit of an injury on his ankle, I believe, but he seems to be playing. I've just looked. He's actually in the same quarter as Nadal for Monte Carlo starting today. Well, it's actually the qualies have started now. So I can see Dominic Thiem. Away from Dominic Thiem, honestly, I can't see anybody else hurting Nadal except for himself. If he can go through injury-free, then I can't see anybody other than Thiem beating him. What I will say is that there's no way, and I've had quite a few complaints about me saying this, Nadal cannot go through the clay court season unbeaten again. I mean, he like I said, he lost once last year. Surely he can't do that again. I mean, he's the way he plays, the nature of the way he plays is unbelievable. Zverev, he killed last week in the Davis Cup, and it was a crucial match. So obviously, you know, Zverev.
He's another name that's been mentioned
as somebody who could take
challenge.
I don't think he can take him out on clay. Last week it was men versus boys. It really was. I mean, Nadal just destroyed him and made him look like an average player. I think other than those two. I don't see. There's a couple of guys coming up on the tour that you wouldn't really have heard of just yet. A Chilean guy called Nick Jarry, who is unbelievably good on clay, and I can see some big things from him. But we're in that transition period. I mean, I just looked at the draw, and with the exception of Thiem and Nadal in the top half of the draw, there's nobody. I mean, there's no Del Potro, there's no Federer, obviously, there's no Murray, obviously. Djokovic is also in the top eighth of the draw. So top quarter of the draw. Djokovic, if he gets through, which, by the way, I don't think he will, but if he did get through to the pre-quarters, he would play against Thiem, who I think would beat him comfortably. If he managed to get through there, he'd have to play Nadal. So it's a very, very different look in terms of the seeds now.
Eisner, that's another name that's been doing the rounds at the moment. Can he back up? He's had a bit of success of late, hasn't he, over in Miami?
Yeah, I mean, the Miami result was incredible. And John Isner will, I think, should always be remembered for making the most of what he's got, because he's not the most naturally gifted guy. Yeah. He should have been a basketball player. Obviously, he's 6'10", he's huge. He makes the most of what he's got. And unbelievably nice guy. I was actually at Wimbledon when they did the world record thing over there, and that was just a joke. It was comical how funny that was. But I can't see how he could do any damage on the clay of Europe. It's too slow for him. He's not a physical player. He needs to get a lot of cheap points with his serve. So, looking at it, I think we're going to probably see somebody young, somebody new coming along that maybe we've not really sort of thought about in the same category as even the Zverevs of this world.
Well, one name that is being mentioned, and I'll put my hand up here and say I've not heard of him before, but I should have, because he's in the top 20, I understand, at the moment. Tell me more. Diego Schwartzman.
I mean, Diego Schwartzman is you look at him, he's unbelievable. He's like 4 foot tall. I think he's the smallest guy on the tour, if I'm not wrong. I think he's only about 5 foot five. And he is incredibly gifted, beautiful hands, and he's managed to compete against the big dogs. But again, I just don't think his game's big enough to really cause any real damage later on in the slams. I mean, I'm just going through, as are you, through the list. I mean, you know, there are youngsters coming through now that you think, okay, maybe this guy. I'd love to see Fabio Fognini deliver something. I mean, the guy's a character. I think that, you know, the game needs these kind of guys, and. Yeah, when he wants to play, when he feels it, yeah, he's beaten Nadal on multiple occasions, and he's beaten him on clay. So, you know, it's not like he couldn't do it. Marin Cilic, no, he's not going to cause any damage on clay. Just going through some of the names. Notice that Kai Nishikori's back now as well, so it'd be good to see. He could, if he can stay injury-free, could cause some damage. But other than that, it's very, very difficult to look past Nadal. I can see that there's Carreño Busta as well. He's had a good bit of form recently. Yeah. So again, but he's like a poor man's Nadal. Lucas Puig, you know, I said it to you last year. For me, that was the best display in a Davis Cup I've ever seen in that final against David Goffin. I mean, the guy was just unbelievable. So, yeah, I think Lucas Puig is another one that if he can stay fit, if he can stay focused, then he might be able to cause some damage. I'm interested to see David Goffin as well. I don't know if you knew about this, but the injured eye that he got playing against Dimitrov. I spoke to Dimitrov about that during Dubai Duty Free, and you could see he's clearly shook up about that. And if you look at his results, he's not won anything since then. So I think there's more to that injury than meets the eye. And they say he's fine, but he got murdered in Miami and Indian Wells. So hopefully he's all right, touch wood. But you haven't spoken about the girls yet.
Where do we begin on them? Where do you want to start with them?
I mean, I think it's very, very difficult to look past people like Halep. Obviously, playing so well in general, but just, you know, is she going to be able to get a slam? Muguruza looks like she's coming into a bit more form now as well. I've got a massive soft spot, as you know, for Kazik Kina, Dubai runner-up. She is a former French Open junior champion and incredibly gifted young player. Really, really got the, for me, she's got the best hands on the tour for the ladies, can do pretty much anything with the ball. But yeah, I mean, I think the ladies draw, as I've said many, many times, you just stick a pin in it. You don't know who's going to win it. Who'd have thought Ostapenko last year? I certainly wouldn't have shouted that one. But when you look at the players right now, I think as we go into the clay court season, I'd like to see the likes of Wozniacki probably should do quite well. Obviously, very, very consistent. But for me, all eyes are going to be on Halep to see whether or not she can get that slam.
It's really weird, isn't it, that we're sort of here discussing the clay season, discussing the fact that we're going to be coming into a couple of the big tournaments over the summer months as well. There just seems to be that sort of shadow over tennis, doesn't there? That almost that umbrella over tennis where we're talking about all these potentials, but in the background you've got the Williams sisters who are the shadow over the women's game. What's going to happen with them, and which tournaments are they going to choose? And then of course the big guns in the men's tournament who are each battling with their own injuries, their own little demons, their own this, that and everything, and yet they are that sort of shadow over the men's draw as well.
Absolutely, and I've talked about it quite a lot recently, you know, that Federer and Nadal right now and the Williams sisters are giving the younger players, the younger breed, the opportunity to step up. It just seems like no one wants to do it. It's like no, everyone's scared to actually take on the mantle, and especially in the guys. You know, you've had pretty much Nadal out of the first part of the season. You've now got Federer out of the second half, the second quarter of the season. Who's coming along? Who is it going to be? Because no one, maybe Zverev, maybe you could say for Zverev, but he hasn't really had a great season so far. Where's Shapovalov? Where's Kyrgios? Where you know, Kyle Edmund got to the semi-finals of Australia. Where are these youngsters? Koric has had as a consistent season, but they're not taking titles. Where are these guys? They need to step in there.
It's funny, we're having the same conversations about tennis at the top of the men's game and the women's game we had a decade ago. It's the same guys and same ladies. It's the Williams sisters, and it's Nadal, and it's Federer, and it's still a little bit of Djokovic, and it's still Murray who's young. But literally a decade ago, we were having the same conversation, and we're blessed to be in an era where we look at some of the greatest athletes of all time, whether it be the Williams sisters, whether it be Federer and Nadal, and it's going to end at some stage.
What's the story with Williams? I mean, is she
both Serena and Venus are fit. I mean, they're ready to play. It's just whether or not whether or not Serena is fully match fit. She's obviously not. She didn't do that great in Indian Wells or Miami. But, I mean, this is not her part of the season. You know, Serena should do a Roger right now and literally just focus completely on Wimbledon, because she could comfortably come back and win Wimbledon. And I think she will win a slam. But I think, you know, getting back to what you were saying, I think of two eras in tennis. I think of the era that was Navratilova and Evert, when, again, you saw all these young up-and-coming players up until Graf came along, but it was very much the later part of the career of both the careers of Evert and Navratilova. And now, obviously, we've got Federer and Nadal. There's never been two better eras, in my opinion. The problem that you've got in the women's game is that Serena is light years ahead of the rest. Just light years. I mean, she is up there. A stat which, it was Omar who said this to me the other day, 23 Grand Slams in her career. Are you aware that she hasn't played in 15 of those, like 23 slams, but she's missed 15 out of her career? Federer hasn't done that. Nadal hasn't done that. 15 slams missed, and yet she's won 23 of them. That gives you an idea of just how much domination she's got. So I think if she comes back, I've said this all along as well, if she comes back and wins a slam, for me, she is the greatest athlete of all time. Men, women, aliens, whatever. She will be the greatest athlete.
Does this sort of make something of a mockery of the whole, do we have to readdress the rankings and the point system at the moment? Because if you've got dominant players like that in both the women's and the men's who are selecting which tournaments they want to play, they're not bothered about world rankings now or anything like that. They're just bothered about longevity. And does that send the wrong message through to players coming up through those rankings? Or again, is it one of those gilt-edged opportunities that are being presented to them?
I think it's a gilt-edged opportunity, and we come back to Mark's point about the Davis Cup and the Fed Cup. You know, where are the youngsters coming through? I mean, you know, like I said, It's still being won. I mean, Puy did it last year for France. Great. Fantastic. Del Potro did it the year before for Argentina, but it's not exactly young. But, you know, then it was Murray before him. Yeah, you look at these guys, and why aren't they jumping in and winning these titles? You know, like I said, if Nadal, touch wood, it doesn't happen. Yeah, if Nadal got injured, he would probably go down outside the top 10 because he's got 4,600 points on clay to defend. I think he's only got 5,000. Well, I think he's got 6,000 points, 7,000 points. So, you know, the next guy's got to come along, but just seemingly no one's willing to do it. I thought Del Potro was going to, but I think he ran out of steam over the Sunshine tournaments in the States. But I don't know. I mean, in the women's game, Henin almost was able to do some damage with Serena, but she obviously didn't have the longevity for that. Kleisters as well, Capriati as well. But the game now, I believe in the men's, has reached a peak. I just think that the standard of tennis will not be as good in my generation. Obviously, technology will change. They'll improve the technology, and it might look as impressive. But I think it's a plateau. It's a Bob Beamon time of life. Yeah. You know, 30 years, I think he had the long jump record for. It's going to be a generation or two before we actually have the quality of tennis that we've had over the last decade. For the women, Serena just, for me, hasn't had a rival, because her sister's not been a rival, really. And if she'd have had a rival, I don't think anybody would question whether or not she has been the greatest of all time. I don't really necessarily think it's in question anyway. But if she'd have had a rival, it would have been phenomenal to see just how the sort of the situation in tennis, how much it did for ladies tennis. Because right now, I hate to say it because everyone will slag me off for it, but, you know, women's tennis is not really getting any bums on seats. And it needs to have rivalries. Everything needs rivalries. Even football has rivalries, even individually with Messi and Ronaldo. Everyone's fascinated by it. Women's tennis hasn't got that rivalry, and until it does, it's always going to suffer.
Talking of rivalries, get ready, because we've got live coverage of Crystal Palace against Brighton, one of the great modern rivalries in football. Time now for us to hear from the respective managers of both teams, Roy Hodgson and Chris Hampton. They've been having their say ahead of the kickoff.
On each occasion, they were tight games. We're playing a very well-organised team, a team that knows exactly what it's doing and does it extremely well. Hard-working team, so add to that the derby factor, which is of extreme importance for both sets of supporters. This is a really big game for both Brighton supporters and Palace supporters. Add all of those things to the mix, it's going to be a really big occasion, but I believe we're ready for it, and I believe our supporters are ready for it as well, and I think it's going to be a really good occasion.
For whatever league position we're in, and for wherever we end up, or, you know, wherever it puts us at any stage, you know, that's the challenges that you have. You know, there are a group of teams below us at this moment, and their challenge is to get as many points as they can. Certainly, I would still rather, even with the games that we have, and we have difficult games, I'd rather be in a position where we have a certain amount of points, as opposed to, you know, desperately having to get them. But there's still a long way to go. We will certainly have to pull out, I think, you know, some good results, because I think there are groups of teams below us that are very capable of winning their games.
Adam Bridge is your match commentator for that one that's coming up next. Big thank you to you all for your comments and contributions throughout the show. We'll be back again this time next week between 3 and 6 live from Brasti for another grill. Till then, though, it is a big thank you from all the team here to all the team on the ground here, but also all the team back in the studio. Thanks also to Paul Espy for joining us today. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you very much. A pleasure as ever.
Good to have Espy on board, as it has been good to have Arch on board. What's happening in cricket?
Good to see you, Tom. Yeah, I'll give you a quick update before we leave. It looks like Delhi Daredevils will inflict the third consecutive loss on the Mumbai Indians, the defending champions in the IPL, in the first of this doubleheader in the IPL today. Delhi Daredevils currently 181 for 3. They have 10 balls remaining. They need 14 runs, but Jason Roy is the key. 77 not out. He's at 5 fours and 5 sixes to look like getting Delhi Daredevils home for their first win of this year's season. Fascinating viewing. The second match coming up in the IPL is from Eden Gardens in Calcutta. It's the Knight Riders taking on Hyderabad, and I'll see you soon.
Thanks so much indeed to Arch, to Espy, and of course to all of you.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.